We will call to order the Monday, June 21st edition of the Ways and Means Public Safety Subcommittee. Today we're hearing testimony, public testimony, and it's a public hearing on Senate Bill 555, affectionately known as the Triple Nickel. Before we get into our list of witnesses, I'll ask staff for an overview.
Basically, members of the subcommittee, with the exception of Senator Gordy, have heard some of this discussion in the context of the ordinance authority budget. We did have an overview at that time of the governor's juvenile crime prevention partnership. Senate Bill 555 has some differences from the juvenile crime prevention partnership that was originally in the governor's budget, but what the subcommittee did in both the Oregon Youth Authority budget and the Criminal Justice Commission budget was to remove the funding elements from that, pending this later hearing on and action on Senate Bill 555. So Senate Bill 555 is now the policy vehicle for the Governor's Juvenile Crime Prevention Partnership with some additional wrinkles to it. What you should have in front of you, there are a number of things in front of you. You should have the A gross version of the bill, which is as it came out of the Senate Judiciary Committee. There is the staff measure summary from the Senate Judiciary Committee, which gives you a brief overview of the bill. There is a fiscal impact of the bill, the A gross version, which our legislative fiscal office has done. And then there are some other copies of testimony that you'll hear from folks that are presenting this afternoon. At this point, we do not have a work session date for this bill. That will come later. There are likely to be amendments to the bill. I'm aware of at least three different sets of amendments that are under discussion. But at this point, the purpose today is to have the invited testimony to get an overview of Senate Bill 555 as it is now, and then have public testimony on that so that you can get a flavor for what's in the bill.
Mr. Chair, thank you. How many days have been assigned for public testimony beyond today?
I don't know that any specifically have, but my intuition is that we're going to spend 3 or 4 days on this. This is obviously a very significant piece of legislation. It will be one of the capstones, I think, of this session, and I'm not in any hurry to produce a bill. I am in a very committed state of mind to produce a comprehensive quality piece of legislation.
Well, I really appreciate hearing that. Thank you.
This is important to a lot of people, and there's been a lot of effort put forth by many, many stakeholders, very heartfelt, well-qualified, well-intended. Some of it's different, some of it's divisive. They don't all agree.
Well, I will tell you, I'm very pleased to be here and be a part of this discussion. Senator Hamby and I both co-sponsored the Governor's Juvenile Crime Prevention bill last session, which successfully made it through the Senate, and then ran into a different fate elsewhere. But I'm personally pleased that the issues are back and that we are grappling with them in the way that we are. And I have every confidence that we will come out with something that's beneficial to young people.
I think that's incumbent upon us here in the committee. I've gotten this bill. I asked for this bill. I'm happy the co-chairs offered it to send it to our committee. I think they sent it to this committee because of the people and the acronyms on this committee, and it came with no baggage. So go forth and do good work. That's what we're here for. For those of you that are standing, again, let me announce we have a fire regulation and an overflow concern. So for those of you who are standing, we have an overflow room. It's hearing room C, which is directly down the hall to the east. There is audio being provided in that room, so you can hear what's going on. We apologize for any inconvenience. Again, if you can find a chair, sit down. That qualifies. But if you're standing, hopefully that applies foremost to Steve Marks. I did want to see that guy on the floor. That's wonderful. Anyway, we do have fairly strictly enforced fire regulations. So the overflow room is hearing room C, and there is audio available in that committee hearing room. Any other presentation from staff?
I would mention in response to Senator Gorley's question that if there is additional testimony day scheduled for this, it would not be tomorrow. There are other bills that will be before the subcommittee tomorrow, so it will be scheduled later, so you'll have a break in this one. Okay.
And that is true as well. Any questions for staff? Great. Well, we appreciate each and every one of you being here, and we're going to try to get to as many as possible. So if we've got no further questions for staff, let's get on with our public hearing and first call up Pam Curtis from the governor's office and Dean Furman from AOC, and we will begin. And as an overview, if I could ask you and all the presenters today to focus on the use of resources, emphasize local processes, and explain any mechanisms or standards of accountability and or measuring of outcomes, if you have that in your presentation. I think the committee would appreciate that.
For the record, Mr. Chair, my name is Pam Curtis. I'm a policy analyst in the Governor's Office of Health Care, Human Services, and Labor. And my role in this morning, or this afternoon, is to set the overall tone, explain a little bit about the policy framework behind the bill, and also the budget framework that led the governor to the members in his proposed budget. This actually started in January of 1996 when the governor asked then Attorney General Ted Kulongowski to chair a task force on reducing juvenile crime through prevention and early intervention programs. This actually was the second task force in 3 years to study and recommend how to address Oregon's growing juvenile crime problem. The task force issued their report in September of 1996, and it represented literally the work of hundreds of Oregonians at that point. The introduction from Attorney General Kulongowski described the report as actually the beginning of the strategy, not the end. It would acknowledge Oregon's children as our most valuable resource. Some of those task force recommendations have been implemented, for example, work to reduce the overrepresentation of minority youth in the juvenile justice system, and clarifications to Senate Bill 1. But Senate Bill 555, which is before you today, represents the next step in implementing various components of that overall strategy, and it emphasizes these task force directions: early identification and early intervention of high-risk youth, the coordination of resources, the engagement of community and citizens, the evaluation of effectiveness and the use of proven principles and practices in our programs, the instigation of performance-based accountability measures, the implementation of a multi-stage, multi-age approach to reducing crime, and the establishment of a means to coordinate and connect state and local services and resources. Senate Bill 555 indeed proposes this multi-stage continuum of state and local services, early childhood, high-risk juveniles, and then connecting them in between alcohol and drug treatment services for families who have young children and for adolescents. These services will occur inside a consistent statewide policy that provides direction and guidance, with local flexibility for planning, for strategy, and for implementation. We will be implementing a consistent evaluation framework for each effort, and each effort in turn will be woven together into a comprehensive plan that's designed to meet the needs of each individual's community, children, families, and youth. I want to illustrate how this will work. Conceptual framework here, can you hear me okay? Conceptual framework here is that we would have a coordinated comprehensive plan for children 0 to 18 put together in a local community. The local community, members of local community, citizens, professionals, and others would gather around the table to produce this coordinated comprehensive plan. And we would have the same kind of activity happening at the state level. The idea is that this table would be facilitated and coordinated by the Commissions on Children and Families in each community and at the state level. So if I work for the Commission on Children and Families or I'm a member of that commission at my local level, I have the responsibility of coordinating and convening the folks in my community to develop this comprehensive plan. And according to Senate Bill 555, the comprehensive plan will be comprised of a series of individual pieces of work, the first of which is an early childhood system of support. And so the folks in that community who are concerned and working on systems and support for our youngest children and their families will come together and design a portion of that plan for early childhood and for families who have young children. The organization at the state level that they will engage in most often is probably the Commission on Children and Families, as they have the state counterpart to that role and will be working on setting guidelines and policies, or at least convening folks and guidelines and policies for the early childhood system portion of that plan. Another portion of the plan will be alcohol and drug services, prevention, and treatment. So folks in the community who are concerned about these will be getting together to devise a portion of that plan working on alcohol and drug prevention, alcohol and drug treatment. They, on a statewide basis, relate to something called the Council on Alcohol and Drug Abuse Program that's chaired by a man named Michael Sweeney, who you'll be hearing from a little bit later today. And I might note that many of these pieces of a coordinated comprehensive plan already exist. What hasn't happened before is that they haven't been brought together to look at the whole system. So right now you have a series of unconnected and disparate pieces of a plan, but not an overarching plan. Another portion of the plan will be juvenile crime prevention, services to prevent crime among high-risk adolescents and their families. And the body that relates to that at the state level is the Juvenile Crime Prevention Advisory Committee, and you'll be hearing from them later today. It's our intention that we start with this policy framework, and we continue to build on the policy framework by adding pieces over time that need to be added to this comprehensive plan. We already have plans in the works to start looking at the mental health system. We know that that's one that has not had a lot of attention and needs at present. So when you get all of that finished, get something that looks like this. So essentially what you have is that each part of this coordinated comprehensive plan, and we've been working on pieces of this for some period of time. Each of these pieces has gone through at least 1 year, and in the case of the high-risk juvenile partnership, as Senator Gordley already pointed out, several years of negotiation and system building among a broad group of stakeholders designed to see what you have, who have worked on designing what you see in front of you in Senate Bill 555. Some of these stakeholders will be testifying before you today and talking about the components of this coordinated plan. So during this testimony today, what I think you'll hear is that you'll hear about a defined role for the Commission on Children and Families that's illustrated on the graphic by the yellow box in coordinating and facilitating the development of this comprehensive plan for children 0 to 18. Senate Bill 555, I want to say, doesn't change anything else about the roles of the Commission on Children and Families except to grant them the authority to convene and coordinate the activities necessary in their community to develop this comprehensive plan. That's identified in sections 14 through 17 of the bill. You'll also hear today about an initiative to reduce and prevent juvenile crime through coordinated strategies that are targeted at high-risk youth. Again, as one portion of this comprehensive plan. That section is described in Senate Bill 555 in sections 36 through 44. You'll hear about the development of an early childhood system that includes the direction to state agencies to consolidate their administrative functions, to coordinate new and existing programs, and to connect our youngest children and families with the most appropriate type of support. All this will be done yet as another portion of this coordinated plan, and it's described in the bill in Section 20. You'll also hear about the improvements in the appropriateness and the efficacy of alcohol and drug treatment services. This is in sections 31 through 35 of the bill, as yet another portion of the coordinated plan. And finally, you'll hear about a consistent evaluation framework that's based on and built on the Oregon benchmark. If you're interested in that section, it's section 19 of the bill.
Pam, could you go through that summary of the major components and sections again?
You bet. And I've distributed with my testimony a section-by-section summary of the bill. Sections 4 through 17 deal with the yellow box on the graphic, the role for the Commission on Children and Families. Sections 36 through 44 deal with the high-risk juvenile crime prevention portion.
Okay.
Section 20 deals with early childhood.
I'm sorry, what was that?
Section 20.
20.
Deals with early childhood. Sections 31 through 35 deal with alcohol and drugs, treatment and prevention. And section 19 addresses the evaluation portion. And again, what we have here is that each of these portions will be evaluated according to a consistent framework. That's new. Some of these pieces have existed independently in the past, but none of them have been evaluated according to a consistent evaluation framework. So what we think we're doing here in Senate Bill 555 is a systematic approach, a multi-stage approach to supporting our children and families in Oregon. It doesn't remove or move or transfer power or control from one group to another. It's not a sweeping reform, and we don't think it does a bit of damage to any existing program or agency. It wasn't the intent of this bill to detail which programs should be funded or which approaches should be taken by local decision makers. Instead, what we attempted to do was to set up a consistent policy framework, as you see illustrated, and an integrated service system, and in so doing, try to integrate our resources and our efforts so that we could combine the best of proven practices brought to the table by experts, but also the wisdom of citizens and communities. So it was meant to be flexible enough to ensure that any individual program can be and should be coordinated with other strategies. And it was designed to provide a concrete method to ensure that both state and local programs are accountable for the resources that they spend. I want to take just a minute and provide a little bit of budget perspective by showing you another chart. And you have a handout that addresses this with my testimony.
What page is that? In your handout,
last
Pam?
Page in the
last page.
Last page.
All right.
So in the government's proposed budget, the amount of $20 million for expanded alcohol and drug treatment program was proposed, along with a focus on families with young children and adolescents. $30 million was proposed for community-based juvenile crime prevention strategies aimed at high-risk youth, and $7 million additionally was proposed for early childhood support. Those budget figures were proposed in the context of the largest budget scenario, the one that you all deal with every day, to balance the investment of state resources. So in the context of that scenario, which is now on the overhead for you, Oregon's current investment in children is inequitable. As the overhead shows, this biennium, and that's what this refers to, the 1997-99 biennium, we spend more than twice as much money on programs for 0 to 5-year-olds as we do on 13 to 18-year-olds. Of any age group and any level of risk, and let me just take a moment to point this out to you. On one axis here, you have ages, obviously, that's very clear. So on this axis, you have essentially levels of risk going from any child in the general population, your children or mine, to children who have an identified condition and have been part of our system. Abused children, children who are caught up in the youth authority system, children who may live in our mental hospital, for example. The third category are those children who are at risk. So of any of those age ranges and of any of those categories of risk, we will spend less on the 13 to 18-year-olds by at least 50% of any other age or any other level of risk. Comparatively, we'll spend this biennium over 7 times more on at-risk young children as we do on at-risk adolescents. So the governor's proposed budget was not a comment on which kind of youth or which level of risk deserves more investment. Rather, the proposed $30 million, $20 million, $7 million was an attempt to ensure that we had a continuum of investments for youth of all ages. And that our investment was one that starts to give us positive outcomes for all our kids and families. An inadequate or an inequitable investment yields insufficient results. So it's also important to you, I think, to note as you continue on in your budget deliberations that the investment package I just described, which was contained in the governor's budget, was proposed by making reductions in existing programs and costs. For example, in order to finance the $20 million investment in alcohol and other drug treatment, reductions were taken in other programs within the DHR budget. The same is true for the $30 million in the high-risk youth plan. Reductions were taken in the budget for the OIA and the Department of Corrections. What you also might remember is that when the budget for the OIA was in front of you, it was additionally reduced by 43 beds with the assumption that that local high-risk youth plans would be funded and the commitments to the OIA from local communities would be reduced as a result of that. So to give you a perspective on local outcomes and impact, Commissioner Dean Furman is with me. Commissioner Furman represents the Association of Oregon Counties. She chairs the state Juvenile Crime Prevention Advisory Committee and has been actively involved in leading many of the discussions that led to the development of Central 555. I want to take this opportunity to thank Gina and the AOC for their hard work and partnership. They've been our primary partner in developing the policies that are before you today, and they were actively involved in crafting the high-risk juvenile crime prevention partnership.
Thank you, Pam.
Hold on just a second, Gina. Any questions for Pam before you let her off the hot seat? Let me compliment you. You did not touch the microphone. I think that's the first witness in a month. Well, it's a good omen, right? Anyway, excuse the interruption. The only nice thing I'm ever going to say about you. Please proceed.
Sure, Westland. Committee member. As Pam said, my name is Gina Furman, and she already told you my role. I'm also a county commissioner for Tillamook County. And my role is going to be one of an exhorter, if you will, and I'd be free to answer any questions about outcomes, etc. afterwards. While we sit here and debate about funding levels of Senate Bill 555, it is apparent that our children are about ready to lose again. We have debated this issue for years, even before House Bill 2004 was passed in 1993, and I know many of you have been around and gone through those debates. The debate and subsequent research and review of successful efforts has led to the development of a comprehensive strategy along the continuum approach that seeks to broaden and balance the juvenile justice system. This planning process has already taken place in all 36 counties. We need to coordinate them a little bit better, and that's what Senate Bill 555 calls for. But all these pieces really have taken place. Done well and with adequate resources, these comprehensive juvenile justice plans can deal more effectively with the most serious offender, provide immediate and intermediate intervention for other delinquent youth, and offer prevention services for children and youth at risk for crime and delinquency. Long and broad participation has resulted in establishing points of agreement and partnerships of shared responsibility have been formed. The result has been Senate Bill 555. And while putting enough resources in the whole continuum of the Comprehensive Juvenile Justice Plan would probably fall into the hundreds of millions of dollars category, state and local partners have planned around a fiscally conservative $30 million for juvenile crime, $20 million for alcohol and drug programs, and $7 million for Healthy Start programs. With the majority of crimes being committed while under the influence of alcohol and other drugs, how can all of us tell our constituents that we are only willing to put a couple million dollars into alcohol and drug programs? How can we be valuing a high-risk youth so little? This is a unique opportunity for you, our legislators, to take the lead in showing support for the work that the state of Oregon and the counties in Oregon have worked so long and hard to achieve. I urge you to fund Senate Bill 555 at $30 million for juvenile crime prevention, $20 million for alcohol and drug programs, and $5.5 million for Healthy Start, of course, the other $1.5 million being the federal match. In addition, Senate Bill 555 holds the Juvenile Crime Prevention Advisory Committee responsible for accountability, and we are committed to supporting local planning processes while providing the technical support needed for them to make good, informed decisions. With your help, this can be a win-win, for high-risk youth, our citizens, and our government. And as the chair of the JCPAC, we are committed to have some strategic planning processes. As soon as you decide what you want to do, we're going to go back and make sure that we do exactly what you called for. Thank you.
Sherman, excellent testimony. Any questions for our friend from Sylvan County? You did great. Seriously, good testimony. Thank you for being here. Okay, next let me call Linda Wagner, present and accounted for. Enter and sign in, please. Don't touch the mic.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Linda Wagner. I'm the Research and Development Coordinator at the Lane County Juvenile Department. I appreciate this opportunity this afternoon to speak with you all. I would like to cover 3 points within the context of the Juvenile Crime Prevention Plan. The first point is a review of current conditions. What we know from looking at statewide and county-specific data on the very predictable nature of a pattern of juvenile crime in our state. The second point is our goal, how we can reduce and prevent juvenile crime by focusing on youth at most at risk of ever committing their first offense or committing repeat offenses. And once we identify who they are, providing effective services to prevent that from happening. And the third point is, once we've looked at current conditions, see where we want to go in crime reduction, how do we measure? What are some relevant and specific outcome measurements to say, what was the impact of these efforts? And for my brief time with you today, I'm just going to give you a couple examples of those outcome measurements, but you'll see the relevancy as tied to the current data. So I'll start with a brief review of current conditions, what we know about juvenile crime in our state. And to describe that, and you have handouts of this information as part of this first one, and consider this data. What this tells us is, it answers the question of all youth who had a criminal offense in 1994, how many came back, and how often did they come back over a subsequent 12-month follow-up period. So what we have is, there were 20,781 juveniles with a criminal offense in 94. Of that group, they committed a subsequent 22,405 crimes. But when we look at how often did they come back, we find this very large group, 13,512 individuals of the total, who had zero new crimes over 12 months. So 65% of all offenders had 0% of new crimes. When we break that down, we can also see that 13% had 12% of new crimes, or 2,848 individuals over a year follow-up had one new crime each. Really, the bottom line, what we see when we're trying to identify the chronic group, those with 3 or more new offenses, we found that 13% of all offenders committed 73% of all new crimes, the smaller group committing the majority of the offenses. I'll just briefly show you that graphically. So graphically, this is what we see then. Out of all of the offenders in 94, about 65% had 0% of new crimes versus the 13% who had 73%. You can really see that inversion going on of the youth that we are successful with versus that smaller group who are chronic. You need to do something different, something very targeted, something very specific to alter this. And we saw this pattern in every county we looked at. I'm going to briefly show you 4 counties' data. Just to show you how predictable this information is, these data are. With Marion in 1994, 2,232 individual juvenile offenders. They represented about 7% of their 10 to 17. Of this group, 65% did not go on to commit a subsequent crime over 12 months. Of this group, 20% had 1 or 2 new offenders. But I'm going to focus on the chronic group in each one of these counties to move along faster.
Linda, you say they didn't go on to commit a new crime, from what date are you measuring that?
Mr. Chair, from the date they had their crime in 9 years old had been eligible for the study, we went out 12 months exactly from that date. So each youth had a similar follow-up period. 12-month period.
From the date he committed the crime?
Correct.
So Lenny, you know, he commits the crime in January. He might be arrested in February.
He's in some form of incarceration or, I mean, probably, you know, cut to his parents or whatever.
Right.
He goes to trial in March, gets 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 months of community service or whatever. And some of these would have been sentenced to OYA, I mean, some pretty serious stuff.
Right.
I guess I'm having trouble finding significant, if it's the date he committed the crime, you know, by the time he gets all the way through the process, and then those that committed crimes that were of, you know, of less enough significance back out on the street for him to commit 10 more crimes, trying to come up with an extreme example, for him to get caught for one, you know, within that year period, I'm failing to find any, you know, relevance in this number that, you know, 65% of the kids didn't commit any more crimes.
So what was the date?
Which I'd love to believe.
The date we look at is the date the crime was committed on the police report. And then we go out 12 months and track that information. We did not, in this study, track for days of opportunity. That is, if the youth or any of these youths were ever locked up, that is included in the 365-day follow-up.
Representative Patrick.
I just have a couple questions. One, I know that the data we're looking at is 94 data. The overall federal crime index data is trending down right now for Oregon. I'm just wondering what the relevance between the 94 adult data was and now we're in 99. Does it follow the adult data? Does it not follow the adult data? What's it doing? I mean, we put a lot more officers on the road, but we've done some more things than that, and this is pretty old data.
Mr. Chair, Representative Patrick, I have some information from Wayne County that shows the 4-year trend data, and I will compare that to the rest information you're talking about. So if you get
there, okay, then I'll wait for you.
When I get there, I'm going to specifically address that.
Okay.
I'm sure.
I have a problem, too. In 1994, now we have increased incarceration. I used to not even be able to put them away, period. About maybe 11%. And so now we are, and that has just come online in the last 2 years. Will not that have an effect on this group that are committing the major offenses? 13,000 of those, and it's 65%. Are we a little premature in trying to analyze the situation that all of a sudden we have to put these kids away and we haven't been able to see what that effect would be yet?
I think, again, when I show you the trend information, you can see over a long period of time, I'll talk more about what those changes, those environmental changes, how it might affect the data.
And the trends would show a lot
here. What I'm showing there for each county shows for this year that a smaller group is committing the majority of the crime. But we'll see this in the trend data I'm going to show you for one county. We've seen it in national data. We've seen it in California study. We've seen it in Utah study. What we're showing is there is a very specific, predictable pattern in juvenile crime, regardless of what kind of resources the community has or the changing environment. We consistently see that the smaller group of offenders are committing a majority of the crime. And I think that'll be clear with the trend information rather than this 1-year snapshot. And using the 1-year snapshot to show you the similarities among counties. The trend information will help address some of these points.
I just want to catch what you just said, because what I heard you say was there's a predictable pattern of juvenile crime regardless of the resources that are expended.
Regardless
and we're still talking about expending resources, and so
I want to be clear what you said.
Regardless of the types of environmental conditions which affect the REC data, which is what we most often use and look at, the kinds of environmental factors, but number of laws of enforcement, the point that you brought up, Representative Patrick, those will very much affect the number of arrests. More officers, more arrests. Less officers, less arrests. Regardless of that number between counties, we still see in recidivism that a smaller group of kids commit a majority of the crime, regardless of what happens with the arrest data. In other words, this pattern is showing us that we're doing really well with what I'll show you, kids with low risk factors, but those with multiple risk factors need a different kind of intervention.
Mr. Chair, I still have a problem. So the reason is what the investment we've made in this area in the last 4 years, probably the biggest investment we've made in history as far as and Mr. Hillback is here, I'm sure would verify this, as far as beds, to put these kids away that have been. And we're talking about that increased rate by the 65%. We have to be putting them away now while we weren't putting them away. We weren't. They were left on parole or what have you, because we just didn't have the beds. You had to commit murder to get in out here. So, are we in agreement on that?
Am I asking the question wrong? I think that's a paramount issue. It's got to be fairly tough right now to determine the effectiveness of all the money that we've spent.
And this measurement, Senator Sam, shows us the percent of chronic juveniles. But we need to also look at, and have the data to do that, are violent offenders. And then what is the percent of chronic and violent? Because I think a lot of the kids who end up in secure confinement are more of the violent youth, and this represents all chronic kids. So we could have a lot of property misdemeanor offenders who are chronically delinquent versus the violent group. So we need to look at them separately and look at, so the youth being locked up, yes, what is the outcome? What happens?
Okay. Well,
let's let Linda proceed ahead here. I think we're asking questions that she's about to answer.
And I'll move on to showing you with the county data from Marion, with 2,232 that had 14% of their voters committing 75% of all new offenses. Down in Union County, with 185 individuals, they experienced 15% of all of those being committed 78%. So again, the number of youth is simply that smaller group committing the majority of the crime. Now this is, again, the data between counties. In terms of looking at it over a period of time, I have looked at Wayne County data for 4 years, 94, 95, 96, and 97, and asked the same question. Given the number of juvenile offenders each year, how many crimes did they commit over the subsequent 12-month follow-up period? This is what we found. These are the number of offenders for the 4 years, and then the different percent. And what we have is, for 94, 95, 96, and 97, this is the percent of youth with no new crime. About 68% each year over 4 years went on to not commit. They did not commit subsequent crimes. About 13% had one new offense over 12 months. About 6%, almost 7, had two. And again, this predictability of the chronic group with three or more new offenses is about 13%.
Linda, do you have any of the same data that shows 2 years out, 3 years out?
I'm collecting that now.
Well, wouldn't you have that? I mean, if this is 94, 5, 6, and 7, wouldn't you have that same data?
Yes, sir. What I meant to say was, we have the data. We're conducting the analysis now with a different time period, with a 24-month follow-up.
And that's how soon will you have? I think that's a critical issue. I'm still very concerned about this 1 year. You know, from the time I go out there and vandalize, graffitiize Judge Thornton's car, you know, and the time the law enforcement catches me, I go through the process, I serve my time, you know, I mean, a year's. Where you park, Judge? Anyway, you see where I'm coming from.
How soon do you have that data tabulated, the results available?
I'm looking on the Lane County data now, because I have that data readily available to me. The statewide data, with OIA is the lead agency. I'm doing that analysis. I'm not sure what the timeline is for the 24-month follow-up.
Rick, do you have any of that stuff done?
Not at present.
Okay.
It looks interesting in these data. To an earlier point made about changes in arrest rates, in Lake County, arrests have gone down. But within the group of youth who have been caught, we still see that smaller group each year, very predictable here, that smaller group that became crime over and over again, even though arrest rates have gone down.
So that pattern stays similar, even though we're making more success in terms of arresting fewer kids.
And to put this in the context, again, of the statewide data, just looking at the overall youth population, what we see are this blue box represents all youth in the state who are part of the initial 94 recidivism study. This is still the 9 age group, this is the 10 to 17 group. And what we just saw from the recidivism data for that year follow-up was out of these youth, 10 to 17, about 7% had a criminal offense in 94, 20,781. And of this group became chronic. The 13% who went on to commit a majority of the crimes.
Puts it in a proportion of, one, not all criminal offenders are chronic, you know, the smaller group, and two, most youth in the community aren't having referrals to criminal offenses. But it does drive three challenges. Who is reference for three challenges which the Juvenile Crime Prevention Plan is taking on? Those challenges are, of youth in the general community, how do you identify those most likely to ever commit a crime? Who's knocking on this door for this youth? Who's ready to become part of this green policy? And once we identify them, what services do we provide to prevent that from happening?
And so for a second-time offender, how do we identify who's most likely to become chronic? Who's going to end up committing the majority of the crime? And earlier on, what do we need to do to prevent that from happening?
And then for the chronic group, the self-identified group, well, we know who they are, what do we need to provide to interrupt their chronic behavior, prevent them from going on to the adult system, and prevent them from passing on the criminal pattern to their children, so we know it's similar for their families?
We address those three points, and you can have a significant impact in juvenile crime because you're gearing resources at youth most likely to be here, you're identifying them, and two, you're providing best practices, proven strategies to prevent and intervene in criminal behavior.
Representative Patrick.
I'm interested to know what kind of money has been spent on these chronic offenders, if these are the chronic offenders from 94, on a per-individual basis, what kind of county combined resources have been expended upon these on average?
Are you asking Representative Patrick of the group in this, the chronic group, or what has been...
No, in the chronic offenders, what percentage, how much money has been spent on them?
I don't have that information. I don't know if anyone in the room has a sense of what...
I haven't looked at that information.
Well, I guess I'm just amazed that we're being asked to fund some of this without even having any numbers as to how much money has been expended upon these kids in 94, and then we're just being asked to throw more money at it, and I'm trying to get a number for how much money has been spent on these chronic offenders. If they're committing such a large percentage of the crime, then I would think we would want to track and see what kinds of programs are effective and see what kinds of money has been spent on these kids' programs before we just become... before this committee and asked us to allocate more money. And if someone has the data, I'd like to have it to know how much money is being spent on these kids. I mean,
but if you go back to Pam Curtis's numbers with regard to, you know, you got to extrapolate a little bit here, but the identified condition kids, you know, kids with specific, you know, law enforcement issues, it's $222 million. In the 97-99, and then the at-risk would be, you know, this in the 13-18 group, you know, is $35 million. If you go 6 to 12 and 13 to 18, it's, you know, around numbers 5, $500 million. Do you want to talk to that at all, Pam, just briefly? Can you come up and identify yourself, and just in case you forgot, don't touch the mic.
I thought you were going to ask Mr. Sheriff if I forgot who I was.
If you touch the mic, we'll know who you are.
Mr. Sheriff, Representative Patrick. The information I have prepared to share with you today is general information. I can get more specific program information for you if that
she
would be
is Pam Curtis.
Thank you.
For the record.
But the general picture information that's represented again on the overhead will tell you that of that identified condition, those are youth who are actually identified as when we talk about the 13 to 18 year old population. Those are kids who generally are in the youth authority system. They've already committed a crime. They've already been identified as being part of that chronic population. What Sentinel 555 proposes to do is to answer some of those questions that Linda just posed for you and to say, what can we do before they become chronic offenders so that we can avoid spending $222 million on them? That's what this is proposing to do. It's proposing to take it up a notch. I put it into that category where we spend $35 million, which we think is insufficient, do a better job of targeting those kids who are highest at risk, and then number two, using programs that we know work, either because they've worked in other places in Oregon or they've worked in other places in the United States.
But, Pam, I think what... Well, you go ahead. I didn't want to...
No, go ahead. Anymore.
What I think Representative Patrick is trying to get at is some of those kids that were identified up in... Linda's bar, that, you know, one little, you know, the green part of the, or the red part of the chart, you know, how many of those kids are repeat chronic offenders? I mean, you've got some kids in there that, you know, one time. Yeah. I mean, isn't that correct? Wouldn't that be correct? I mean, kids incarcerated, yeah, up in the, where she's got chronic offenders.
This group
yeah.
had three or more.
Three or more, okay.
The yeah, that's fine. Was defined as three or more in your
well. That's fair.
The green is the one
below. The green one group of kids had of this group, the offending population, and of this group, 13% went on to be chronic.
Okay, hold on. Representative Patrick is what started this. I'm glad he did. And you got questions.
Well, I'm just trying to see what resources were spent in 94 on those 2,856 kids who are the continual chronic offenders who are causing such a big crime problem out there. What kind of resources in 94 were spent on? What were those resources? And then of those at-risk kids, what are the trigger points? I know we have Rick's budget in here for OYA in front of us, and I don't remember all the data that Rick gave us, but that's what I'm trying to figure out is, you know, if we're going to be asked to spend money and prioritize how much money is spent with this Senate bill, I mean, I've got to know from my vantage point how much money was spent on those chronic offender kids, who is one component we're trying to get at, and what their problems are. I mean, do we need to spend $20 million on alcohol? Is alcohol and drugs the driving force in that? You know, what are all the driving forces on in those areas that are the triggers in order to make some kind of financial decision to fund these kids to try and deal with some of these chronic offenders that catch them early or, you know, those kinds of things.
Mr. Chair.
Well, Ms. First, did you have a response to that?
Mr. Chair, the information, the budget information that we have before you today is for the current biennium that we're in. I understand that the study was done in 1994, so we'd have to go back and dig a bit to get you the 1994 budget data. I think what we might be able to say and what Linda could confirm is that it looks as though this pattern that she has proposed or that she's found here carries on in the ensuing years. And so what she showed for 94, I think we can assume is true for the present as well. It's not something that was an anomaly for 1994.
Not changing dynamic in terms of essential components.
Representative Nancy, I'm sorry, Representative Patrick, do you finish with that?
Well, I mean, I just want to say, I mean, it trends. I mean, it trends. When people get older, they commit less crimes. When, you know, I'm trying to get a handle around this.
You want the aging factor built in?
Well, I think the aging factor is important to be built in on the chronic offenders, and I think the other factor needs to be built in is the numbers. I mean, how much money are we being spent, or what kind of programs are we spending it on these chronic offenders?
Okay.
Do you have a response on that?
I do on the aging factor, Mr. Chair.
This does include all youth committed a crime in 94 and past the 12 months. We control the present, looked at youth 16 and under for the follow-up time they couldn't age out of the system and just tracked their recidivism rate, and it was a similar pattern. Of that group who were not, couldn't age out because they were too young, the smaller group of them committed the majority of the crime. The pattern was exactly the same.
Mr. Chair, I've seen the presentation before, both in Lane County and here, and some of the other things that we've done. What I remember and what this has shown to me is the money that we're putting in now has been very effective at about 65% of the population that we're addressing as through the programs we have. Now we need to start focusing on what we can do to keep the people that fit into the chronic category before they reach that point, and that Linda will be showing us some different components as to how this can and what are the environmental factors and other things that are driving forces and why we may want to look at putting additional funding into specific areas to address that small portion. And maybe at some point we may want to look at the amount of money that we're currently putting into the system, shifting some of that over to this other area, because we may not need to be put quite as much in, and we still can catch someone somewhere else. But I think until we get through her presentation, we're going to be asking a lot of questions that may come clear once she has the opportunity to see us.
Here's what we're going to do. Ms. Wagner, I'm going to pause for a moment. I think Senator Gordon was in the queue. I'll bring her up, and then I'm going to ask you to roll on and summarize. I think as we put this into context, at the one extreme, we're dealing with a group of people who've already come into contact with juvenile authorities. They've had at least 10 offenses. So we're not dealing with the universe. We're dealing with people who've had some difficulty. So we already know there's some risk of some kind. You're trying to identify a range of risks from extremely low to extremely high, identify within that a subgroup, and try to identify things to attack that with to deal with the issue. And I know you'll be making that presentation, just trying to put this in context. But let me hand this over to Senator Gordon, who at least before I was paying attention, I was told, had a question, and I apologize for the delay.
No problem. This report, this snapshot is 22 reporting counties. If you added the other 14 counties that you don't have a report from, does it change the snapshot at all? What would you suggest?
Senator Gordon, there were 22 reporting counties because they had automated data for that year. We're adding the other 14 counties with 95 and some more of them had the automated data.
Mm-hmm.
I don't anticipate, given the predictability of this, that it will change the pattern.
Thank you.
Okay, cool.
Okay, any further questions? Okay, move on, please.
Well, the basic question, and Pam mentioned it, Representative Kozanski had mentioned it, is how can we earlier on prevent youth from getting here? And we know, after 40 years of research, that youth with multiple risk factors are at greatest risk of ending up in this red box of being chronic offenders. I point out the 40 years because it's an important researchers over time, different backgrounds, different philosophies, different disciplines, are all converging on the same findings that youth with three or more of any of these risk factors are high predictability, as high as 80%, that they will end up in that kind of group. And I don't believe you have those handouts in conversation. But the risk factors in the area of individual care, significant family problems, school attendance or performance problems, and substance abuse. And there are very specific behaviors within me that identify instances of risk factors, like the individual peer, the acting out, the age, if they're associating with deviant peers, chronic runaways. These are specific behaviors that this is a risk factor. Same thing with significant family problems. We know that youth who have been abused and neglected are at higher risk of ending up in that red box. School attendance. It's not just any school problem. It's youth with two or more kids who are chronically truant. Substance abuse is a risk factor. We've seen over years of research high correlation between drug use and delinquency. And the number one reason chronic juvenile offenders is in that red box. The number one reason they're using drugs, self-medication. A lot of grief and loss in their life, a lot of pain. Why? Well, they're in families where there's abuse, they're hanging out with negative peers, family adults involved in the adult system. They're using drugs and alcohol to self-medicate that pain.
high correlation between these risk factors and the youth who end up as chronic delinquents. So efforts right now to develop a standardized assessment tool that can be used at the community level or in the juvenile department to identify youth early on with these multiple risk factors. After we identify them, the question is, what do we do? We need a very targeted, proven approach, research-based, to intervene in their lives. And there's research out now. I just brought two guides for implementing the comprehensive strategy published in 1995, Preventing Crime, What Works, What Doesn't, What's Promising, out of the University of Maryland. Over 8 researchers from around the country worked on this document and was published last year. It shows us very proven interventions to work at the community level, prevent crime from ever happening, with first, second-time offenders, prevent them from becoming chronic, and even with that chronic group, research shows us that we can successfully intervene in their lives by holding them accountable, providing community safety, and working on these risk factors. Not any one of them, but we know you have multiple risk factors of greatest risk, so they need an approach in multiple domains. They need an approach that deals with school, family, substance abuse, whatever their issues are. And once you provide that, identify the youth early on, provide effective services, you should see some specific outcomes. Those are maintaining the Oregon Youth Authority cap, it's always been tied to the juvenile crime prevention plan. But given the data we've just seen, well, if you identify kids early on and prevent them from committing a crime, we should see a reduction in first-time offenders. Of the first, second-time offenders, we identify who's going to be chronic and provide proven strategies, we should see a reduction in repeat offenders. Since we're focusing on the risk areas, we should see a reduction in risk and an increase in protective factors around these risk domains. Now I have some specific examples of what some of those outcome measurements would look like. If you need to check in with you, since there is time during the time, would you like me to go through those specific outcome measures or wrap up with this general overview?
What's the depth of that?
It's about 4 more slides. And this isn't comprehensive, it's just to give you an example of what a specific outcome measurement would look like, referring to the box of high-risk youth. This one focuses at the community level, so we want to prevent you from ever committing that first crime, so they have an outcome of reducing the percentage of first-time offenders from age 6.5, for example, by 2001. The baseline tells us it's at 8. We want to identify more issues early on to prevent them from getting here. This shows us where the data is, what the data is that we'll be tracking, who has it, and what kind of analysis we will conduct. And this is important because it shows the outcome for all youth on this specific measurement. And then says we will break that down by age, gender, and race ethnicity so we can see the effectiveness within subpopulations of youth. Another example of a specific outcome focuses on youth who have that first criminal offense. We know that's true in the data, a certain number will commit a crime, so we want to prevent them from ever getting to that red box. That's the goal. Interrupt reduced juvenile crime. A specific outcome for that would look something like this. Of all first, second time offenders, reduce the percent who become chronic. Baseline tells each county what your chronic rate is. We're going to go from 13 to 11 in Wayne County by 2001. How are we going to do that? Using juvenile department data. This group is currently collecting it annually and will review it for all youth and then break it down by the source. And another specific outcome measurement is that chronic youth, which are already in the red box, we're going to intervene. We know on average they commit about 5 new crimes over a year. That's our baseline. Every county has that information, what their rate is of new offenses. So this county, for example, so we're going to intervene in that. We're going to reduce their average number of new offenses from 5.4 to 4 by 2001. Here's the data we'll be using, recidivism data. It's collected by the Juvenile Department and the Recidivism Group, which is OIA, Oregon Juvenile Department Directors Association, and the Oregon Commission on Children and Families. As a partnership, they will analyze this rate of change for this county and then break that down for self-use. So I did want to go through and show you, given where we are, what we know from the baseline data, saying where we want to get to, reduce and prevent juvenile crime by identifying high-risk kids, both in the community and first and second-time offenders, and then provide proven research-based interventions that 40 years of research tells us works in the community or with the first-time offenders, even works with interrupting chronic juvenile offenders. We're going to use these proven strategies, and we're going to see these outcomes. We're going to see a change in that pattern. What we saw in that Lane County crime scene, we want to see more youth with zero, one team with crime, and fewer in that crime scene.
Question?
I'm concerned. I don't see anything here interfacing with schools, regulating schools. Where you interface most of the schools or when you know they're at risk
before they've ever been caught. I'm sure they probably steal or do things four or five times before they get caught. We need to know who the at-risk are because we work at that hard in the 0 to 5 and they're showing all the money that's spent on it, so we should make that productive money that we spent to have these children analyzed before they even get to these other two areas.
Mr. Chair, that would be similar to this first outcome here. In this one, we want to work with youth in the general community and prevent them from ever committing their first crime. One area, one infrastructure to do that is definitely the schools, who are a partner in the juvenile crime prevention plan. So where do we identify youth with multiple risk factors in the general community? Schools, number one resource to tell you, I think it teaches to tell you who that 20% are, of looking, identifying youth with multiple risk factors in the general community. The school is the most likely place where you can do that and provide or conduct that assessment, talk to those school folks and see who they're seeing with these kinds of risk factors. It's interesting when I present this information of a small group of kids committing most of the crime along with folks from the school, you know what they tell me the research shows? About 20% of all kids in the school commit 80% of the crime itself. Smaller group, went back and back to the principal's office. I think we're talking about the same view.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a logical place in the prevention side to identify who's most likely to get here and do something earlier on to work with their responsibility.
Okay, then who makes that connection? The schools make it, the juvenile? How do we put that together? Are the people that are going to school daily that are in the juvenile area to check on this and find out who the truants are, who the ones that are problem with? What I need to know is the web.
How
we're spending these millions and millions of dollars.
And in the plan, the partnership includes juvenile department, health, mental health, local listing, and school personnel, who's developing and set up a county-specific plan on how they're going to identify this. So that partnership has been developed or is being strengthened through the juvenile crime prevention planning.
And the purpose of the Commission on Children and Families, which is brought up sooner, would be that coordinating place.
Yes, they're a member of the group that worked on the plan also. I think we'll have a full list of all the different partners, but we're naming some of them who are involved in the planning strategy.
Okay, thank you. Questions? Okay, continue.
Again, I appreciate the time. Thank you.
Thank you, Linda.
Next group up is Preventing Recidivism, Rick Hill, and Steve and Larry.
Mr. Chair, while they're coming up, I'd just like to commend Linda Wagner for, I've heard this presentation on a couple of other occasions, like the good representative, and she does a fine job. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I agree.
First up, Rick Hill. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Rick Hill, Director of the Board of Youth Authority, and I'm here today with Larry Oglesby and Steve Carmichael in support of Central 555. We specifically are here to talk about Section 36 through 44 that deals with the Juvenile Crime Prevention Partnership, but I think you'll find from our comments that we support the entire bill. and if we'll all work very hard to make it a workable piece of legislation. It was about 2 years ago that we started doing the planning under the Juvenile Crime Prevention Partnership concept. And in my view, during that time, what we've seen are state agencies that deal with at-risk youth are working more closely together on solving these issues than ever before. And state and county agencies that work with at-risk youth are working more closely together than ever before, as evidenced by the fact that Steve and Larry and I are up here at the table at the same time recommending the same thing to this committee. We've also seen 36 juvenile crime prevention plans produced at the local level and subsequently approved at the state level. If there was a national model developed for implementing a juvenile crime prevention strategy, I believe it would look very much like what Oregon has just done in the last 2 years. And I say that for four reasons. First of all, our planning has been based on best practices and research-based proven programs, as Linda Wagner has just mentioned. Our strategy has specific outcome measures required. We have an evaluation component worked into this agreement, this strategy. And all of the planning was done at the local level by local folks who understand their local needs, local arrest rates, local resource gaps, local issues. Both Steve and Larry will talk more extensively about who exactly was involved in local planning in their counties. All of the sections of this bill are important to us, but if you focus for a moment on section 51, sub 4, which is on page 28, I have, that's the basic services budget line. Although we're not here to argue budget lines today, I want to point out that originally this had a $10 million amount in the Youth Authority's budget. This is called basic support services, which would pass from the Youth Authority through to the County Juvenile Department. It would be distributed based on their proportion of 0-17 age population. This money is for long-time unmet needs in areas of detention subsidy, shelter care, assessment of youth, as well as various graduated sanctions that are needed to keep youth crime-free at the local level. If fully funded at the $10 million level, along with the other $20 million for high-risk youth, I believe that it would slow the growth of the bed forecast for the Oregon Youth Authority. And again, I want to remind the committee, as Pam Curtis did earlier, that last month under your hearings on HB 5055, the Youth Authority's budget, $10 million was taken out. Additionally, money for 43 beds is taken out because we are assuming that this strategy will be successful and that we will not have to fund at least 43 beds that were forecasted to be needed by the end of the biennium. Senator Timms and Representative Westland and I know Gina Furman, who testified earlier, were all present when we did the ribbon cutting at our new regional facilities around the state. And the Youth Authority expanded, doubled our bed capacity, and opened those new youth prisons. And at every location, somebody, maybe Senator Timms, it was you, maybe it was Representative Westland at Ochoco, said, this is a good thing that we're doing, but I really wish we could be putting the same kind of money into prevention so we would not have to have additional youth prisons. Now's the time for you to do that. You have this opportunity. You've heard the governor say we should invest at least as much in prevention as we're investing in punishment. It costs about $30 million a biennium to operate those five new regional secure youth facilities. This prevention plan, not coincidentally, is for $30 million for the high-risk youth and the basic services. In addition to the $20 million for alcohol and drug treatment for youth and families, within the Department of Human Resources budget. I strongly urge the committee to fund this bill for a full $30 million in crime prevention and $20 million in A&D services for the Department of Human Resources.
Okay, thank you, Rick. Questions?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
The one thing I would add to what Mr. Hill said about Oregon leading the way, I'm kind of paraphrasing what you said, and in reference to those 36 county plans, juvenile plans, the other thing we're getting at is the equal access of services for girls and also people of color. And so I need to hear each of you say something about that access and your perspective on where we are now. Because a part of what we're doing here is changing the way that we, that we're finally addressing, fully addressing the needs of populations that have not been adequately addressed.
Mr. Chair, Senator Gorla, I could just perhaps start by saying that when the 36 plans came in from counties, they were reviewed by a team of state agencies, plus it went to the JCPAC, which, of course, is a 21-member group of state and local folks. And it was apparent that although some of the counties addressed the issue of equal access of services for young women and the disproportionate minority confinement issue, others did not. And what we decided to do, what Governor Kitzhaber decided to do, was to approve the plans contingent upon their participation in some training. So several agencies, Youth Authority included, have been putting on around the state training sessions on diversity, on cultural competency, and how to weave that into your county plan for juvenile crime prevention, as well as the whole issue of special needs for young women, as well as boys, gender-specific services. And I think we're on our third or fourth go-round of this training now, and it's building, and there's, I think there were 80-some participants in the Eugene Lane County training. I think there were 36 or 40 people that showed up at the Coos Bay, Coos County training. So tomorrow they're going to Ontario and be putting on this training again. So it's really paying off. And it's really a learning process for a lot of parts of the state that has not dealt directly with either of these issues before.
Thank you.
Okay, further questions? We're going to move on to the next speaker. Introduce yourself, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Larry Oglesby. I'm director of the Marion County Juvenile Department and here representing the Steve Carmichael Juvenile Directors Association. To supplement the written testimony which I provided you, let me say that we are in support of the entire bill, but the testimony today will focus mostly on the juvenile crime portion. That's the portion that Steve and I and a number of others have lived with on a daily basis for at least the last couple of years on the original work groups that developed the strategy and then developing local plans. So I'd like to talk a little bit about what this means in terms of the local juvenile system. We're here today to ask that you fully fund the 36 county plans that have already been described. We believe that they were developed by hundreds of local volunteers and professionals to address local needs, as you've heard. In our county, there were 27 people on our local task force, and those included state agency partners, local partners, private nonprofit folks, youth, and various others in the community who had an interest in youth, an interest in juvenile crime, an interest in having kids become successful. But to be effective in this effort in reducing and preventing future juvenile crime, we believe this effort does need the $30 million. Those 26 plans were based on that, and we believe that they are solid strategies, research-based, that will produce results if fully funded. Let me say, though, that we're not asking that you choose between services targeted early prevention intervention and those for the adolescents that we deal with who are likely to become serious and habitual offenders. We believe both are vital to an effective strategy that will help us reach the goals of reduce juvenile crime and healthy, well-adjusted children, which, after all, is the overall goal that we all want to see. Inadequate funding for either of these groups will not get the job done, and it's critical for us to employ a comprehensive and integrated strategy that is research-based and addresses the needs of children all along the age continuum. This $30 million package, to give you some historical reference, would be the first significant infusion of resources into Oregon's local juvenile justice system in well over a decade. And that is, in fact, a decade that is seeing crime committed by youth become more frequent and more violent, and our ability to respond has not kept pace with that. Reductions in funding at the local level due to the passages of Measures 5, 47, and 50 have also had an impact, along with other factors, And that coupled with the increase in the number of offenders and the severity of the criminality have made it much more difficult for us to meet the needs at the local level. The result then is continued erosion of our ability to hold delinquent youth accountable and provide both the incentive and the assistance they need to reform. And let me say that that is our goal, is to provide that level of accountability for kids, but also to give them the skills so they can be reformed and can be productive citizens and not creating additional victims in our communities. The Juvenile Crime Prevention Partnership strategy has allowed each of those communities to identify the needs specific to that local community. And the 36 counties, we find 36 different sets of service bases and other needs that need to be addressed. The counties that lack, as an example, additional detention space like ours and many of the others have targeted much of the money to address that need, while other counties have focused on different priorities that are specific to those needs. The other real strength, I think, of the strategy is the focus on youth most at risk of continuing or becoming juvenile criminals by focusing on the risk factors, as you've already heard. And research shows that those risk factors are the most predictive of future delinquent behavior, and the results can be both preventing and reducing juvenile crime. And if I can comment a moment on the questions earlier about the money spent in the system for these serious kids, the reality is most of ORI's budget goes for the serious chronic offenders, and the reality is most of the juvenile department's money goes for that because of the number, but also because of the cost of those services. The services for the most severely delinquent are the most expensive we have, out-of-home placements, training school beds, detention beds. Those are the costs. And if you do a quick extrapolation, we're probably looking at $100 million at the local level of spend in addition to what the OIA spends. So the goal of being able to recognize who these kids are early and prevent them from becoming the serious chronic offenders is really what this strategy is all about, to be able to target them early on so that we're avoiding the future criminality. An example of that is the high-risk strategy developed by our Marion County Task Force. We've developed a plan that chose to focus on 11 to 14-year-old first offenders with three of the five risk factors. But in addition to focusing on those youth, we're also offering services through this plan for entire families, including siblings and including parents. We know that many of these youth are delinquent because of lots of things going on in their family, substance abuse, domestic violence, and other factors that don't just involve the youth, but involve siblings and, in fact, involve the parents. This is an approach that the national research shows is most effective, both in dealing with the behavior and also the family conditions that contribute to it. So, and let me also say, in regard to our local plan, addressing the issues that Senator Gordley raised, one of the basic strategies that we have for our basic services is to expand our guaranteed attendance or GAP program. It's currently a 10-bed residential program for boys only that are youth who are in school programs or in working community service programs during the daytime and under supervision at night. This money would allow us to expand that to 25 beds and for the first time offer that program for girls who in many ways are most appropriate for that kind of a program. Girls typically don't pose a safety and security risk that boys do, but they certainly need that level of supervision and that level of structure that a program like this would afford. In relationship to addressing people of color, we have a growing Hispanic population in Marion County, rapidly growing. One of the things that we've tried to do to address that has been in cooperation with the Children and Family Commission. We've just completed a federal 3-year grant to help recruit people of color into the juvenile system to make the system be more competent in terms of cultural issues and better able to serve people of color in our juvenile system, both the state and the local level. But to kind of summarize here, what we're not here today asking you is just to give us the money to continue the current programs, although that part of the package that Rick mentioned is very important. Basic services is one of the keys to the cornerstones to the juvenile system, and where we don't have the ability to hold kids accountable, that is a critical factor. What we know is that when that is that situation is in place, kids don't take the court orders very seriously, the behavior shows that. Where you do have the ability to provide the level of accountability, we believe that we've seen that kids' behavior changes. We've been working on this high-risk portion of the strategy, as I said, for several years, going back to 1994. You may recall the statewide juvenile summit that we sponsored in Eugene. We've had two governor's task forces involved in this. This is an issue that goes back a long ways and that we've been trying to address. We believe we've done our homework, identified a strategy that will work, and been proven to be successful elsewhere, and targets the youth with whom we can have the greatest impact. And I think that's really the key. If we're going to spend a lot of money, and let's face it, this is a lot of money, we should spend it where it's going to have the most impact. We ought to be able to measure that and come back and show you what the impact of that was, and that would be our goal to do that. And finally, let me just say, while it's important for our quality of life to reduce juvenile crime, which benefits victims, it benefits offenders, and the community at large, we also believe that juvenile crime prevention strategies should be viewed as an investment, really a business decision. Our success at the local level can result in less future costs to the state to build prison beds, add prosecutors and judges, and provide representation for defendants if we're successful in these strategies. The sooner we get started, the sooner we can reap those benefits and begin to allow us to shift our efforts to earlier intervention and prevention programs, which I think is where we all like to see. The question regarding schools, that relationship with schools is critical. I think the schools can identify those kids early on, and the ability to share that information, to get those families who are not yet in the system into community programs is critical to our overall success. We're ready to begin this effort, and we urge you to support this this initiative at the $30 million level.
Okay, thank you. Questions? President Passage.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had two questions for you. One, what role did educators play in developing your strategy for Marion County? I know you probably can't speak statewide. And two, I was amazed when I listened to the Youth Authority budget. There was no money, no additional money, none being asked for, no programs being run really to any extent on deterrence, on getting out to educate the youth. And you talk in your talk about kids don't take things seriously when there's no beds and the low levels of accountability. And I'm just wondering what role and how much money does deterrence play in Marion County's plan? What are you going to do for outreach and getting out?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Package, the first question regarding education and participation, we had a representative of the Salem-Kaiser School District and a representative of the Marion, or actually now the Midwest or ESD, who are both involved in our task force and very helpful in identifying programs. One of the five factors you'll notice is school success, and we run a juvenile department school for adjudicated youth, which is funded by Salem-Kaiser Schools. That's the juvenile department. And our folks in that program are absolutely convinced that school success is really one of the most critical factors. You're looking at kids who are not being successful in school. Those are the kids who are not in the in-group. Those are the kids who are most likely to be showing delinquent behavior as we go along. And so we did build that into the overall plan, and we see education as a strong partner. In terms of the education piece, we, as a county, we have done a variety of things in terms of providing information to schools. Our probation staff work closely with the schools, and so they're out there doing classroom presentations and that sort of thing. We've developed a couple of videos that describe the experience of going through the juvenile department, including everything from arrest to going to detention to going to court, those kind of things. We've made those available to schools. There's a Measure 11 video that was produced a couple of years ago with the Attorney General and Head of the State Police. There's also another version that was produced by a group of youth in Multnomah County. So there are some kinds of tools that can do that. But quite frankly, Mr. Chairman, or Senator Panthers, the education that's most important is the education that goes on word of mouth from kid to kid who can describe whether or not there was accountability or not. If they got arrested and all that the parents got was a letter saying your child has been arrested, that sent a real strong message. So the ability to have those basic services and sanctions in place, I believe, is critical.
Okay, thank you. Further questions? We're going to move to the next speaker, Steve.
Yes, I'm Steve Carmichael. I'm the president of the Juvenile Department Directors Association, and Larry covered a lot of what needed to be said. I wanted to cover a couple of additional points. One is that, as I read in the newspaper articles, I guess, and here in the media, that there's a lot of struggle in the legislature about whether we should spend all of the money on very young children, or when children just enter school, or an adolescent. And I want to argue for a balanced approach of that. Essentially, if you try to do, and I've heard this described a number of times, if you try to just spend it all on prevention and say that'll mean we don't have to spend it later, you miss a lot of kids. A lot of juveniles develop problems later in life. At the point of healthy start, the family's great, they're doing well, and divorce occurs later.
but they weren't picked up early on, or if you just focus on first grade and trying to do something at that level, a lot of kids, when they get into peer groups that are using drugs, develop their problems later. So you really need a range. You need to do the preventive work clearly. That makes a great deal of sense. But if you put all of the marbles there, you try to spend everything there and say, now we won't have to spend it later, that's really a myth. That really is not the real world. And we have a very mobile society. In lots of our communities, people move in who weren't there when their children were very young. They move in with adolescents that are in trouble, and you have to respond to that. And a lot of high-risk families don't volunteer for services. It isn't until they begin to get into trouble that you really have a handle on them, and you can start requiring services. You can start having something happen. So I think the concern that let's just spend the money at any one point in the system is something we want to respond to. It really requires spending money on prevention, but not only there, and not just on the back end of the system either. The other thing I want to talk about is the strategy that's being used. As Linda said, the assessment tools to identify who are those kids in that red block have become pretty sophisticated in the last few years. There are the risk factors that have been developed around the country and in Oregon. We will have a risk tool in Oregon for the state to use, both for juveniles who are coming into the system and those not yet in trouble. It can be used at the school level, as you've asked earlier. That assessment tool is going to be about 80% successful in identifying who are those kids early, before they commit a crime or at first crime. We don't have to wait until they become chronic and spend millions of dollars on them then. So this strategy, statewide in every county, is to identify the right kids in the beginning and then to intervene effectively. Not only do we have to identify them, we have to find what works. And the research is pretty clear about the kinds of things that work. And one of your questions earlier was about drugs and alcohol. What kind of relationship does that play? Looking at any of our probation caseloads in Wayne County, Marion, and others, about 80% of the kids on probation or on parole are going to have serious drug and alcohol problems. To ignore that is to ignore 80% of the problem. It's a huge issue. Drugs are highly prevalent in society, and among the kids in trouble, it's a big issue. Also, the work at schools that you talked about is very critical. In Lane County, we have a student assistant program as part of our project, which will provide school counselors and support for school counselors in the middle school. That's a big part of our local plan in Lane County. I know in many of the other counties, schools have been involved in the design and have a school intervention as part of their program. The plans were unfortunately required to be done during the summer, so in some counties, school personnel were not available to work on the plans, and so that came in later, but when it was missing, we sent plans back for more work for school people to be involved. I do know that about a third of the juveniles on our probation caseloads are not in school. So again, if you only focus on one kind of intervention, if you just look at school, you can miss a third of the kids that are in trouble in Lane County that are on probation. So schools are very important, but they're not the only answer. I guess the summation maybe of that point is that all of the books that Linda held up of what works, it requires a very comprehensive approach. If you put a little bit of money into it, doing something at school, let's do something around drug and alcohol, and you don't really address the range of issues, you're not going to be successful. These juveniles that we will predict successfully are going to have trouble have multiple risk factors, and so you really need to address the multiple risk factors, and it can't just be done with a small amount of money until we're going to deal with these high-risk kids. They're committing most of the crime, but you can't address them with a minor resource. And at last, the evaluation is critical for us. We've built into these 36 county plans evaluation scales that will record whether or not we're successful. And I agree with Linda, we should know that pretty soon. If we address first time multiple risk kids that will become chronic offenders, if we address those effectively right in the beginning, within a couple of years, we should see some results. Those graphs that were so consistent in Lane County should change, and they should change in every county. If they don't, we'll know it. And we'll know if some counties don't have the interventions that are working, they'll be able to measure that. So this is not a long range, 10 years later, we're going to see some benefit. We'll see the benefit within a few years by addressing the right kids with the right programs.
Any questions?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
You're not asking, thank you. You're not asking for more money to grow at a problem. You're asking for dollars. You're asking for an investment in what works. And we know what works because the research tells us what works. And so we need to make that investment.
Exactly. Exactly right. Targeting the right juvenile and then doing the right thing.
Will the, and Rick can probably answer this, first the OGIS system will be in place then for all the 36 counties, right?
The JGIS
system. I'm sorry, I get all those telecommunications updates.
Yeah.
I quote, though.
Yes, sir. Sure. You know, we are right now converting several counties from the old data to the new data. They're hooking up to JGIS as we speak, and it's the partial answer, at least, to Representative Passage's earlier question about, you know, how can we track what's it costing us for each of these chronic kids. We actually will be able to do that in the future because each service that we open will be open on the JGIS system, whether it's a foster care, a foster home, a group home, a counseling program, a commitment to the youth authority, and there'll be a dollar, a daily amount attached to that, and we'll be able to track each individual kid through his career, through the county, all the way through the state programs. We're a year or two away from having a report on that stuff, but we have programmed that in. So we will have answers to those questions in future biennium. I hope that's the purpose of JGIS. It's one of the major building blocks of this whole system, not just for the youth, but for the whole system, the whole state system.
No, I have the same concerns. Here we are. We just finished a $272 million that's in the 13-18. Most of that is probably the OIA, the prison incarceration. We just finished that. What kind of a dampening effect does that have? Because kids know now that they're going to get put away, and we're trying to end the transition times with juveniles. Not that I'm opposed to the funding, but I'm not sure that we have the total amount, and we need to know also what areas you'd want to spend on. What's more important? Is alcohol and drugs the most important? We've gotten it up to $8 million, and it will go higher. What will we do in the other areas? So it's kind of a, and we're probably going to do a pretty good job with this budget, I think. I hope we do anyway, and I'm sure the chair of the committee does. But we need to have some thoughts in regards to how best to do it.
Senator Timms, if I could address that very question, I think the answer I would give, it would be the local plans would be the vehicles to determine that, because it's going to be different from county to county in terms of what is the greatest need, and that's what the local plans indicate. So, I mean, that should tell you where the holes are in the system and what ought to work out.
My local plan happens to be in Burns. It's the 10 beds that are not being used in the juvenile facility that the county can't afford. And that's a lot of money for a little place like Rankin. You know, you're talking around $500,000, I think. But it could be a subsidy to that process where you get it down to where the counties can afford it. They were put there originally for the counties to use, but the counties are not using it. But that's the point. Every local county plan is maybe unique and different. And I hope they're good plans.
I was in Burns last Monday and talked to the court director about that very thing, about their plan. In lieu of detention, which is not a terrible detention, they are putting on an additional probation staff who will work evenings and weekends, who will knock on doors and track kids where their existing staff has not been able to do, and they'll be following up on comments from school teachers and comments on other social service agencies who identify kids as needing some additional help. So with the limited resources that will go to Harney County, which is very small, they will be practically doubling their ability to keep kids out of trouble.
And you're telling me there's no way we get to the 10 beds through there?
Well, they need the cooperation of the surrounding counties.
Right.
Great. Any additional questions? If not, let's move along and we'll try to get everybody in. Thank you, gentlemen. Apologize for my absence.
Things went good.
Let's have our preventing crime presenters, Phil Lemon, Mickey Lansing,
Michael Sweeney and Mark Nelson.
Mr. Chair, Mark Nelson was called away to another hearing. We hope to have him back very shortly.
We will note his degree of prioritization in our decision-making process. And please tell him I said that. Whoever first, take your pick.
I'll go ahead and start, Mr. Chair. Phil Hennessey, Criminal Justice Commission. I just wanted to begin by responding to a couple things that I brought up earlier. Mr. Phil mentioned this wording process, getting your thoughts as a national model, and I wanted to let you know that Gina Furman, the County Commissioner who serves as the JCPAC Chair, will be presenting information on this process to the National Association of Counties late next month. And so Oregon is, I think, in many ways, kind of ahead of the curve on this because of the level of interest by other states. We are preparing a process that will be used and learned from by other states. You asked us to focus on use of resources, local processes, and standards for accountability. So I want to just quickly run through that before I turn it over to these other folks. The resources, as you know, in the juvenile crime prevention portion is $30 million, 29 of which will go to fund the local plan. We've already given you summaries of how each county intends to use the allocated funds. It's generally divided up into basic services, which is detention, shelter care, supervision, graduated sanctions, and then other prevention programs, which are specifically aimed at reducing the risk factors that accumulate to predict the likelihood of becoming a crime. In terms of the processes used, after last session, a group of interested parties was convened, and they negotiated a points of agreement document. And that is what established the target population for this program. It does not have age limits on it. It identifies five risk factors, which, again, as they accumulate, increasingly point us to the kids who are going to commit crimes. And what we want to do is say kids who have more than one of those risk factors and who are demonstrating behaviors that, without intervention, will lead to an imminent involvement in the juvenile justice system, whether that's a new involvement as a first-time offender or a further penetration into the system. And so that was the consensus product that came out of the work group. Each county then was asked to designate a lead agency to develop their planning process. In the majority of the counties, that was the Local Commission on Children and Families. In other counties, the Local Public Safety Coordinating Council did that, and we had one county that used their Education Service District as the coordinating body. While we try to stay away from mandates in this day and age, we had four partners that we wanted to make sure were at the table at every county of the state. One was the Local Commission on Children and Families. The second was the Local Public Safety Coordinating Council. The third was the Local Alcohol and Drug Planning Committee that are in every county, and we want to make sure there's a strong tie-in between the drug and alcohol money and this juvenile crime prevention package. And the fourth was schools. Schools is a little tougher to do because we started in the summertime when there's not a lot of those folks around, and we had to get these plans in on an expedited basis. But we are presenting at the COSA conference later this fall. We are participating in the School Violence Institute. It's an annual event every summer at Oregon State University. And we are doing everything we can to make sure that there's an ongoing and increased involvement with the schools and educators in this. The local process is varied from county to county, but typically it was the group of parties that was identified by the Board of County Commissioners. They had a series of meetings. They typically held several public hearings and gathered input from the community. Some actually, I believe Lane County went into their juvenile detention facility and talked to the kids in there as one of the things they did to develop their plan. And then the plan as a whole was presented to the Board of County Commissioners and approved in a public meeting. So there was a fair amount of public process involved in this. You also asked about the accountability standards. Linda Wagner talked quite a bit about that, so just to briefly summarize, the common goal here is to reduce the juvenile arrest rate. Juvenile arrest is an entry point into the juvenile justice system and is the statewide measurements we have on how much juvenile crime there is out there. We also have agency measures, such as arrests. We have dropout data. We have abuse and neglect statistics. We will use those and distribute those by county so we can track those changes. We also rely heavily on information from the school-based surveys, which identifies risk factors and percentage of kids in school who have one or more of these risk factors. So over time, we'll be able to tell you how the changing in the population occurs at various age levels within the schools. As Mr. Carmichael mentioned, we're developing entry and exit measures by program. and we intend to have Portland State University to conduct a network analysis in each county so we can test the level and the depth of cooperation and how different entities work together in those counties so we can provide them that feedback to improve the local processes. And then also we asked counties an open-ended question about how they would, what other accountability standards or measurements they would use for the program to use this money, and those also included in the intergovernmental agreement.
For the record, my name is Ricky Lansing, and I am the Deputy Director of the Oregon Commission on Children and Families. We are here today to enthusiastically support Senate Bill 555. In 1993, the legislature created House Bill 2004 that created the commission system. The legislature's mandate was to develop and implement a statewide system of services that is preventive, located in communities, accessible to children and families, and focuses on the wellness of all Oregon's children. Well, that was a lofty goal and a noble mandate. The difficulty with doing that was how. Local commissions were asked to create comprehensive plans in every community, that they would look at what the outcomes needed to be. They had flexibility in how they used their funds based upon the needs of those local communities, but they were to convene and facilitate the folks around the table, whether it be the private nonprofits, the local public services, the state services, etc., to look at their systems, hopefully to avoid duplication, to maximize the use of their resources, and in turn have a greater impact on the lives of kids and families. What was difficult about that particular goal was that it was ambiguous. There was a lot of vision in House Bill 2004 with very little authority. Commissions were up and running by the end of February of 1994, and as they started to work with their local partners, they found, in fact, for many of them, relationships had not been developed that were going to enable them to get where they needed to go. I am most happy to say that in the last 4 years, much of that has changed. Those partnerships are being developed. We were asked to develop an accountability system for the use of local resources. We have done that through Dr. Claire Pratt, head of the Family Studies Center at Oregon State University. And we are going, I think, a long ways. In fact, we are being asked from people all over the country to use the accountability framework that we have put in place in local communities. The comprehensive planning process was meant to be a systems approach, looking at systems all along the continuum. While the commission was asked to focus on preventive issues through the comprehensive planning process, they were also asked to focus on all age groups 0 to 18, looking at where are the gaps in services, where are the strengths in your local community, what is it that we can do both locally, statewide, and federally to help what is occurring in local communities. We believe that Senate Bill 555 truly clarifies for that local commission system and for the state commission what their roles are. And for the first time, we believe that they are going to be able to locally do the kind of comprehensive planning that they were actually asked to do in House Bill 2004. We have appreciated the opportunity to be at the table in a very amicable way with our partners, both state and local. In times past, this has not always occurred. We believe that by working together, we are going to have positive outcomes for our kids and families. The State Commission has begun to focus on collecting data so that in the next biennium 2001-2003, you are going to get a much better sense of what those county comprehensive plans look like based upon good, accurate, and reliable data. The state commission will collect that data, they'll aggregate it, analyze it, evaluate it, help convene other state partners, other folks, be able to report back to you, the legislature, the governor, and the general public
what really is happening out in our local communities and what kind of progress are we making. We urge your support of Senate Bill 555. We do believe that $30 million for juvenile crime is essentially $20 million for alcohol and drugs. We understand that we've had $7 million for Healthy Start and also believe that that is essential. And we appreciate your support.
Great. My name is Michael Sweeney. I'm chair of the Governor's Council on Alcohol and Drug Programs for the next 9 days.
And I appreciate you looking at your watch. We have several other people to testify, and we have two members presently in attendance on this committee that are on the negotiating summit, so we got to go.
I'll make this brief. The Governor's Council is required every 2 years to prepare a plan both to the governor and to the legislature. Hopefully, all of you received your copies this year. We focused on prevention. 2 years ago, we focused on the effectiveness of treatment, and out of that plan came the Pagan study, which, of course, many of you are aware of, the $5.60 savings for every dollar invested in treatment. This year, the Governor's Council also, in the past 2 years, not only were we required to review 15 different state agencies, but also we made a decision to go out into local communities to see how things were playing out in local communities. We visited Tillamook, Portland, and Pendleton, the Lincoln City, and we were going to visit Bend in June, but we decided to wait until after the legislature is out before we do that so that the legislators will have an opportunity to attend. They've been tremendous sessions where we bring together schools, different agencies, commissioners, local and private sectors. One of the things that commonly that came out of all three of those meetings in Tillamook, Pendleton, and Portland was this necessity for local planning, especially around the alcohol and drug planning committees. All of them thought that there needed to be better coordination, that there were some partners not available at the table. And we summarized those testimonies that occurred are summarized in our focus on prevention. So it gives you a real good idea of what the communities were saying they needed around alcohol and drugs.
Michael, do we have copies of that?
I don't know what it should have been delivered to all of you, to all the legislators, much earlier. I haven't brought any today, but I can make sure that once again, that you have those copies. Once again, focus. One of the common themes that came out of this was, in terms of focusing on just the prevention piece, was developing a common language. Was also having the partnership between the state and the local communities, where the recognizing that there are certain things that the state can do in terms of technical assistance, and then of course assisting these local communities in developing their own plans around the prevention and treatment. Finally, I want to emphasize and encourage and recommend that $20 million for alcohol and drug treatment. One of the things that occurred in our discussions and investigation last year that I thought was kind of sad is where they take a problem child and maybe after two or three incidences they move them into an alternative school. And so then you have this group in an alternative school. There was one school that they decided to the children. There were 76 children in alternative schools, and all 76 of them tested positive for drugs. And there was no treatment available for them. And the $20 million is so necessary. So we have waiting lists. It's not only just the children, but their parents and the adults. And at some places they have to wait four to 6 weeks for inpatient. On any given day, upwards of 65 people can be turned away from Hooper detox. So the $20 million would go a long way to reducing those waiting lists and are very necessary. And then just finally, you asked Representative Westman to talk about not only local processes, but also the use of resources. In this whole planning process, we found that as these groups of individuals come together, there's a wonderful way to start leveraging and utilizing different resources. An example would be the Governor's Task Force on Underage Drinking. There was
$360,000 available through the federal government grant there. We found that as working together with private communities and organizations, there was also a Robert Woods Johnson Foundation grant of $300,000 that went to a Oregon Coalition to Reduce Underage Drinking. As people wanted to put together like media campaigns, they were finding that, oh, there were certain funds in all these different areas, and by working together in a unified fashion, would be able to start leveraging those resources and stop the duplication. And so anyway, I just really want to encourage, once again, the passage of 555 is that they could go a long way in improving this planning process, especially at the local level.
Okay, Michael, thank you. If I could encourage you to get copies of that report to Linda Ray, our committee administrator, and that, I think, will answer that thing. Why don't our members of the, we now have three members present, and why don't I release those two on the negotiating team to go up to that function, and I'll stay here, and if they need me up there, have them call 170, and I'll stay here as courtesy for the rest of our public testimony and the folks who are here.
Thank you very much. We have Judge Robert Thornton, and this is a privilege and a pleasure, sir.
Thank you, sir. Chairman, members of the Special Ways and Means Committee, I'd like to introduce my supporters here. Mr. and Mrs. Okarski testified on this bill, and they are quite knowledgeable in crime prevention. And then I'd like to have you meet my wife, who is pure Tillamook. I see you gave proper deference to Tillamook in this thing, because I had the privilege of representing Tillamook in the House a great many years ago. I was also had the privilege of serving as Attorney General for four-year terms, and then two terms on the Court of Appeals. And I've been a believer in crime prevention ever since I was, my first term as Attorney General. I established an experimental crime prevention unit in the Attorney General's office. But I was unable to persuade the Ways and Means Committee that this was a popular approach to the crime problem. And I'm very pleased to see it for taking the time and effort to deal with this very difficult problem. It's gotten so much worse since my days.
Let me just say, sir, that if you want to touch the microphone,
don't touch
me at home.
Okay.
Anyone of your stature can touch that dang microphone all he wants.
Well, I'm going to summarize my remarks very briefly. According to the State Department of Education, there are 150 Oregon high schools that teach parenting education and early child development. And this is my pitch here, and the reason I selected this was because I felt that the strengthening of the family was the most important thing I could devote my energies to. I visited a number of them. Most of what I know about parenting education in the schools, I gained right here in this county. And with the school system, I went to the one of our high schools here that has a crime prevention program. A good teacher, excellent curriculum, the whole bit. And I said, "How many students do you have?" He said, "Well, we have 27." Here's a student body of 1,800 students, big high school. Said, "We have 27. I said, "How many boys and how many girls?" "Well, we have 26 girls and one boy." Imagine it, 26 girls and one boy in a student body of 1,800. Then there was a handout in there, a copy of an article that was in the Capital Journal about a teacher writer that writes for them, and she had went to the parenting education class for teen moms. There were quite a number of teen moms there. How many boys? Zero. zilch. Not even the boys that were responsible for them being in the teen moms category. So what I have drawn from in this particular research that I engaged in was the superintendent of Oregon State Police at the time, is Emil Bandow. And I interviewed him as to the underlying causes of crime and what he thought should be done. And he turned to me and he said, "Bob, it all starts with the family. Here's the head of the state police. It all starts with the family." And that's why I sampled a high school age opinion in one of our largest Salem high schools here, and I wanted to get the attitude of the student body in this sampling of opinions. And I ask in your opinion, what do you think are the underlying causes of crime and delinquency here in Salem? What was the answer? This is a small sample. Family failure, family breakdown, inadequate parental supervision. This is where it's starting. So I decided to spend my energy to see what could be done about making the parenting education plan a graduation requirement. And that's where the trouble started, because the educators were opposed to it. They don't like any form of mandated curriculum. They think that, as one of them put it, that we know what to teach, you just give us the money and we'll teach it. Well, there are now 8 states nationally that have parenting education as a graduation requirement. And those would include California, Delaware, Michigan, New Jersey, New York, Tennessee, Vermont, and Virginia. The graduation requirement education in bill form was rejected by the Senate or the House Education Committee, and the no reason given but the published reason in the newspaper account was that they didn't want to make it compulsory. If you don't make it compulsory, you'll never get the boys in the class. And here are the people that are going to be parents, future parents. And so that's why I hope that this committee, subcommittee, will see to it that help is given to the parenting education requirement. I don't know precisely how you're going to do it. One way, of course, would be to make it compulsory, which is, as I say, 8 states now have it. But you're not going to get boys in there any other way. And this method is, of course, only a tiny fraction of the programs that were discussed by the majority of the witnesses here today. And it's important, and I support it. However, I chose to spend my energies to try to do it at the family level, see if we could do it. This is endorsed, the bill that we had, that it was endorsed by all of the law enforcement legislative committee. Every one of them supported it. State police, sheriff's office, the whole bunch. They all support it, and they see it because they work with these kids. But unless you're into this thing, you understand the problem, you don't know, see what a terrific impact the breakdown of the family has done in this whole area. Another one little example I wanted to give, and that is experience with the dress code in the Salem high schools, I think all schools. There are 4 primary schools that have dress code, and it's been amazing because It isn't just the dress that came out of it. It came out of better attendance, less discipline in the classes. Just amazing the fringe benefits that came from this dress code project. It's amazing. And this is true in this thing, that little things in the background that suddenly have an effect on your crime and delinquency problem. Lake LaBiche School, Waldo School, Highlands, Waldo School is a middle school, Highlands School and Hayesville, and I don't immediately have at hand the list of the benefits, but it shows you what you can do by little things and without a terrific expenditure of money. And you're talking about real money in the programs that we've heard about today. Another thing that I did a comparative study of crime prevention in America and Japan. What I was looking at, particularly in the Japanese system, is what is it that is responsible for this low crime rate in Japan? Well, the answer is the family. The family, these are moral values and behavioral norms that have been in those families for generations, time after time after time. In the Japanese families, I did a sampling of their opinion, too, as to how do you explain the practically zero crime rate of the Japanese American population? Well, it's very, very simple. These are the traditional moral values and the behavioral norms that the old folks, the Issei parents, got with them from Japan. And they gave them to their kids, kids that were in my age and were in the Army Japanese Language Program with me. And you ask them what it is. I'll just read you a couple of quotes from well, I won't take time to do it, but they said that you don't do anything because it reflects on the reputation of your family. That's why these kids stay out of trouble. The parents say that you should be proud of your Japanese race and that you don't do anything that reflects on the Japanese people. And you see, this is all built in the Japanese family. And that's what I'm, that's why I put my, all my efforts in trying to get the parenting education being taken by more people. Yes, sir. I don't know how you're going to do it. My personal recommendation is that you make it a graduation requirement. Because much of what we're doing here, and even under the new program, is too late in the ball game. It's coming after these patterns of delinquency have been developed in their environment, maybe right in the house, maybe in the neighborhood. And it's very, very hard to turn them around once that pattern is established. So that's why I say it's too late in the ball game. I think we should do something to strengthen and perpetuate this parenting education and requirements that we have there. We had the testimony by a parenting education teacher at one of our high schools, and she was outstanding. And she told a little bit about how she had conducted these programs. Just remarkable what they'd done. But what can you do with the 26 girls and one boy? How are you going to get the family built up and strengthened any other way? So I leave here with the saying, don't fail to do something about continuing parenting education and strengthening parenting education. I think it could well be a part of this major program. It is only a small part of it. But you'll notice there on one of the in the program of the Teen Moms. They had an item there. Those girls, to have them delivered of their babies and to have them take care of the medical problems, $85 million in the year that was involved for just the medical care for these teen moms and their kids. This is a terribly costly thing, and if you could get the families to the point where they're giving the type of background that we've got at our, in our age group, and I think it's probably true of most of you here, came right in the family. So if there's any reason why I didn't turn into a criminal, I think it's the family that did it in my case. And that's why this, I think it's so terribly important. What was that? Yeah. I'm happy to take any questions you have, but I surely hope that you don't overlook this thing, because this is going to head them off. They're trying to head these kids off before they get into this pattern of delinquency. And the only way you can do it is, I think, through the parents and the parenting education. I've given this a lot of thoughts. I started, as I say, an experimental program in my office when I was attorney general, and I've worked at this thing ever since. And I found some interesting things about the Japanese system, particularly I covered the prison system, I covered the school system, I covered all of the delinquency prevention system, and it's a fraction, their crime rate is a fraction of ours in every category, just a fraction of it. And it goes back to the family. There's your lesson. That's all I have to say.
Any questions for Judge Thornton? Sir, it is a privilege for you to be here.
Thank you.
But we do have to ask you one question. Give me 100 examples of where your wife kept you on the straight and narrow. I know there's plenty of them.
Yeah. Well, she took a very lively part in my career, and she gave her opinion, and she didn't hesitate to express it.
Yeah.
Sir, thank you for being here very much. Is Mark Adams in? Still here? Great. What is that book, by the way?
This is my book that the New York publishers called Preventing Crime in America and Japan, A Comparative Study. I had a Japanese partner. Incidentally, if you want to see this book, you can get it from the State Library, and they'll send it over to you. They have several of them on file.
Good. Sir, thank you very much.
Okay.
Good afternoon. I'm Mark Adams, the Chief of Police of City of Kaiser.
Now, Mark, before you get going, how many times have you arrested Judge Thornton here in the last 30 days?
I'm proud to say now. I'm here representing the Oregon Association of Chiefs of Police and our support of Senate Bill 555. Especially, we want to emphasize the need for prevention at a local level. And I think what Judge Thornton just said really hits home. We've, as law enforcement, we've spent a great deal of our time, we've been very successful in the hunt, but we haven't paid a whole lot of attention to the habitat. And I think that's where a lot of this bill can help us in crime prevention, is focusing on the habitat, what's causing crime, and how to intervene early to keep our young people from becoming folks that we have to build more prisons to house them later. So, I'll be very brief, and just we energetically support the pass to this bill.
Sir, thanks for waiting. Thanks for being here. Is it Ann Ewer? Come on ahead. And I have a list of as long a list of initials as I've ever seen here. Either that or it's her last name.
Chair Westland and committee, that's, I'm the...
And you are?
I am Ann Uhler, and I'm the president of ADAPTAL. That's how I say all those letters, which is the Alcohol and Drug Abuse Providers Program Directors Association of Oregon.
I'm
also the Executive Director of CODA, which is a prevention and treatment center in four counties in Oregon. And I just want to keep my comments brief. I can't imagine you're going to absorb anything after sitting here as long as you have, but I hope you'll remember a couple of things if I can share with you. One is there's a great need for more alcohol and drug treatment in the state of Oregon. We have a long waiting list, particularly in our residential care facilities across the state. Several hundred are currently on the waiting list to get into residential care. This is both youth and adults who families.
What's the average wait, I mean, now, currently today?
From 6 weeks to 3 months.
Okay.
And so we don't have to go out there and case find. We don't spend any money looking for folks. These are folks who are standing at our door who've already made a decision that they want treatment, and they can't get in the doors. Now, remember, residential means that they have their level of disability is quite high. We are getting folks in the outpatient setting fairly consistently, but the folks that need to be off the street, away from their families, those are the ones that are waiting, the ones that most need it, if you think about the difficulty of the problem.
Okay.
That's women with young children, youth, families. The need, in case you haven't seen, there's a very good needs publication put out by the A&D office that was done 2 years ago, done by county, how many people need treatment in the state. So if you haven't seen that and need encouragement about the need, it's a very comprehensive. One of the things it does show is the folks that generally get the treatment in this state are folks who have at least 7 or 8 symptoms already. So when you talk about the whole prevention area, we have to do a lot of work there. So folks that only have 1 or 2 or 3 symptoms are not the ones that are accessing and going for treatment. So that leads me to the next discussion. We've got folks who have very severe disabilities coming in our doors. I've been in the field 25 years now. The field has improved greatly. We know much more about what we're doing today than we did 25 years ago, thank goodness. It's much more scientific. It means that the staff that we hire has to be more educated and more trained. And we're having a real difficulty attracting staff into the field because the funding levels for treatment were made many years ago with the idea that most of the folks you'd be treating most of the folks who would be your staff would be folks in recovery. So part of their recovery was then they became treatment folks. Well, that isn't what we need today. We need folks that who have education, who know what they're doing. We also need folks in recovery, and they can become educated, but that takes longer and it takes more money. And so in order to attract staff into our facilities across the state, we've got to increase the funding and increase their knowledge and skills. So we have this workforce development, we have needs, treatment improvement as part of that, best practices. We know, as I was saying, we can improve. We know what we need to do, but we need to increase the infrastructure in order to do that. We have some programs out there that have some beds. So as a capacity issue, we can turn on the faucet if we can do workforce development and get some money to provide more services. So there's some availability out there. We've just got to move forward on this and get some money to do it. There will be in some parts of the state, we'll have to build some capacity, particularly in residential care. We've already heard about waiting lists and detox. We have approximately one heroin overdose death a day in this state, you know, just to underscore the whole business about the need that's out there. I want to talk just briefly about youth, and I also want to assure the judge that one of the things that happens in treatment programs that for adults who have children with them is parenting education. I couldn't agree with you more about how important parent education is, and we're able to do that. That's one of the things we do, because we want to be able to be involved in that parent and that child. We can see that the behavior, 65% of youth and adults coming into our program come from families who are also alcohol and drug addicted or abused. So we know we've got to intervene in the family. And one of the ways to do that is parenting education. And that's a component of gender-specific, both moms and children and fathers and children in our treatment. So I just want to assure you that that's happening in the treatment world. Of course, the parenting won't work. Parenting education won't work if people are high. So first, we have to get them in, get them sober, and then begin on the parent education. Youth, it won't work. Schools won't work if they're not sober. I mean, it's sort of basic, but very, very important that if we want all of this, all these programs to work, that we've got to get people clean and sober in order to do it. I want to talk just a second, and then I'll leave you, about all the comprehensive planning that's going on. If there's anybody that could tell you what the need is, it's a local community provider, because we're the ones that have to work with the person who comes in to treatment with about six different linkages that we have to deal with, many of whom have no connection with each other. So a youth, we have to deal with the school. We have to deal with the parent. We have to deal with the probation officer. On and on and on. And we're the ones, once they get in our doors, that have to sit down and figure out and pull all these people together and try to get some kind of treatment regime that's going to work. And then the community. So we know there's a great need for this bill to have the kind of community planning that needs to happen, because we can't do it in a vacuum. The other piece is the housing. And that's one of the pieces that's planned in the alcohol and drug component of this, is drug-free housing is a major component in order to be successful. So do you have any questions?
Quick. Any questions? Last witness, Kathy Osborne, and as Kathy's coming forward, let me acknowledge and recognize, or at least have staff acknowledge and recognize that we have several handouts, I think, of people that presented them that I can't testify. So just...
We had a handout from League of Oregon Cities. There's one from Michael Ware, and I'll pass out one from Judy Cushing. So these are folks that had written testimony that they wanted the committee to see, but weren't here to testify.
Great.
And Mr. Chair, if I could just say something about one of those letters.
Of course.
It is from Mike Ware, who is director of Out Front House. You got a letter that looks like this, and it's dated May 99. Mike could not be here today, but he is president-elect of the Oregon Alliance of Children's Programs, which is a consortium of 35 agencies and over 200 programs statewide. He's also co-chair of the Governor's Juvenile Justice Delinquency Prevention Action Group and a member of the Juvenile Crime Prevention Advisory Committee. He's public safety chair for both the African American Legislative Roundtable and the Northeast Rescue Plan Action Committee, and a member of the Public Safety Coordinating Council in Multnomah County. And his testimony has been strong support of Senate Bill 555.
I think you'll have ample opportunity to get back down if your schedule permits. Kathy?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kathy Osborne from Juvenile Rights Project. Juvenile Rights Project is a nonprofit public interest law firm that represents children in Multnomah County. from the ages of birth until 18 years of age. Actually, about 60% of our cases are the dependency cases, which are usually the younger children, obviously, with the other 40% of the cases being the delinquent kids. I've been at the Juvenile Rights Project and a staff attorney for the Juvenile Rights Project for the last 9.5 years. My specialty is the serious and chronic juvenile delinquents. With the fact that we represent essentially every child that we're probably talking about in the continuum here, I can tell you that the Juvenile Rights Project very strongly supports the Senate Bill 555 and the expense, the numbers that the governor has attached to each of the areas, both juvenile crime prevention, drug and alcohol treatment, and early intervention. Our office has been very dedicated in terms of trying to improve the juvenile court, especially on the dependency area. We threatened to sue the SCF, and the result of that was bringing the systems of care into Oregon to try to improve the dependency area. So we find that area to be extremely important, and we agree that it is the area that is the beginning of trying to prevent juvenile delinquents. However, when you're looking at the continuum, it's also important to remember that there are the older kids that are already in the system or the kids that are coming into the system. For the last 9 years, I can tell you that I have represented 12-year-old alcoholics who are in the late stages of alcoholism. I can tell you that I've represented 13-year-olds who are addicted to crack, and I can tell you that I have represented 17-year-olds who have had 24 delinquent referrals and had not been placed at McLaren or Hillcrest. And I'll talk about each one of those. The 17-year-old with the 24 delinquent referrals obviously falls within the chronic offender of three or more delinquency prevention. He was a crack addict. He had a very serious drug problem. His crimes, however, were usually jockey boxing or breaking into cars looking for stuff that he could sell to essentially buy the drugs of his choice. So there were low-level thefts, theft one, maybe a theft two. We're talking misdemeanors. Because they were misdemeanors, he was very low priority on in terms of probation services. He was very low priority in terms of getting into a residential drug and alcohol treatment program. Because he did not inject his drug, but rather snorted it, he was a low priority on the wait list for the drugs. He was on a wait list for drug and alcohol treatment, residential drug and alcohol treatment, which everyone who ever met this young man could tell you was the problem and what was causing his delinquent activity. He was on a wait list for approximately 6 months. The reason it was so long was because he would run away. He would be on the run. His name would come up. His name would go back down to the bottom of the list. We couldn't keep hold of him long enough to get him into residential drug and alcohol treatment. He finally got committed to McLaren, where he actually got the residential drug and alcohol treatment that he needed, and I can tell you today that he is off parole from McLaren, and I ran into him actually about a month ago on the streets of Portland, and he introduced his new baby to me, and he told me about the two jobs that he was holding down. So the fact of the matter is that this young man, had he gotten the residential drug and alcohol treatment that he needed in the beginning when we all knew he needed it, and not having to commit crime after crime after crime with new victim, new victim, new victim, we would have had right there a serious reduction of juvenile crime in the Portland area for the amount of time that he was active. But we also would have probably been able to give this young man back a little bit more of his life and not have to use the bed at McLaren or Hillcrest finally, or at, he went to McLaren, at the bed at McLaren to give him the drug treatment that he needed. This, I cannot tell you the pain that it is to sit with a 12-year-old crying, begging for drug and alcohol treatment, knowing that I'm not going to be able to get her into drug and alcohol treatment. I can't tell you the pain that it is to listen to her while she's in detention, talk to her mother, and for the first time admit to her mother that she is an alcoholic and had been drinking since she was 8 years old. And knowing that I wasn't going to be able to get that 12-year-old into a residential drug and alcohol treatment program was just so painful. And listening to her mother sob on the other end of the phone as she came to a realization of what was going on with her daughter. In fact, unfortunately, with that girl, I ended up going to her funeral because she ended up killing herself because we couldn't get her the treatment that she needed quick enough. Is $8 million enough for drug and alcohol treatment? I don't think so, because I'll tell this committee right now, there is no way I'm going to sit and listen to that phone call one more time. I think we have an equal protection issue going on here in Oregon in terms of our drug and alcohol treatment. The rich kids can get treatment, the poor kids can't. And I'll tell you right now, it's not just the poor kids, it's the middle-class kids who can't do it. The insurance companies pay for 10 days of inpatient residential drug and alcohol treatment. That's it. 10 days. There is no drug and alcohol problem that's severe enough for residential treatment that's going to be solved in 10 days. So that means the state of Oregon has to pick up the treatment for those kids. And I'll tell you another thing is if a family uses those 10 days on one kid, they don't get to use them on another kid. So if they have two children with a drug and alcohol problem, and I've had this situation, they have to choose which one of their children they're going to put into residential drug and alcohol treatment. What position would you want to be in if with as a parent with two kids with a drug and alcohol problem having to choose between which one of your children are you going to help? I can tell you right now, it's not easy for those parents. Now, moving on to the juvenile crime prevention, I've heard time and time again since I've been in this building that it's not worth spending the money on the older kids. They're beyond hope. We can't solve them. And I'm here to tell you that that's just not true. When I took this job, one of the things I realized is I was going to have to remember what it was like to be a kid. I was going to have to listen to their music. I was going to have to watch their movies. I was going to have to read what they were reading because I need to be able to converse with these kids somehow. What I quickly found out is what I thought delinquent kids were like is not what they really are like. I have discussed Machiavelli with a 15-year-old murderer. I have discussed Cicero with a 14-year-old rapist. I have discussed racism with a 17-year-old who is in and out of the juvenile system more times than I could count. These kids have interest, they have intelligence, they have something to offer this community. What we see, however, is that they give up on themselves more quickly or just as quickly as our society gives up on them. They aren't attending school. Why aren't they attending school? They can't read. Why can't they read? They're dyslexic. But if you give that kid a tape of Mark Twain's Huck Finn, they're going to listen to it and they'll be able to discuss it in depth with you. These are kids that have something to offer our system and we're just throwing them away. And as I told you, I'm not going to have that conversation with the 12-year-old and their mother. I'm also not going to let the state of Oregon throw away any more of my clients. I have seen the state of Oregon do that. Before Measure 11 went into effect, I had a conversation with the lead prosecutor out of Multnomah County Juvenile Court, and we were discussing something along the lines of Measure 11. And he was saying, well, it's just the time that we take those 15 to 17-year-olds and we throw them away and we concentrate on the 12 to 14-year-olds. What I'm hearing now is what we're going to say is, well, let's just throw away those 12 to 14-year-olds along with the 15 to 17-year-olds and let's concentrate on the 8-year-olds. My question is, what do you say to the 14-year-olds who we know how to solve the problem, but we just don't feel like we want to spend the money on that person? Do I tell my client who's 14 years old, well, okay, we knew what your problem was when you were in kindergarten and we didn't do anything. We knew what your problem was in third grade and we didn't do anything. We knew what your problem was in fifth grade, we didn't do anything. Then you dropped out of school. We knew what your problem was when we picked you up the first 14 times that we picked you up, but we didn't do anything. But now that you're 14, you're in the magic age that, We now know, we still know what your problem is, but we're not going to provide the services for you because we decided to spend our money on those kindergartens who are behind you. I don't think that's very fair to the 14-year-olds, and I don't think it's in the best interest of Oregon. I think what's in the best interest of Oregon is to spend the money along the continuum. Don't tell our children that they're throwaway kids, because very few of them actually are. I've met them all, and that are in the juvenile justice system, and I can tell you that very few of them are throwaway kids. Most of them can be salvaged, and all of them should be. We should try to salvage each and every one of them. Thank you.
Kathy, what's your phone number?
My phone number is area 503-232-2540, extension 269.
232-what?
2540.
2540.
Extension 269.
Thanks. I don't want to cut you short, but we're 45 minutes late to our next appointment. We appreciate each and every one of you coming. Easy, staff.
Yes.
We are officially adjourned. Thank